I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. As expected in big election years, former politicians are out and about reminding the American people about what democracy stands for. Among them, former presidential candidate and three-term South Dakota Senator George McGovern. In his new book, The Essential America, McGovern, commonly referred to as America's best-known and most consistent liberal, presents a defense of liberalism as the most practical and hopeful compass to guide the American ship of state. He proposes programs for feeding the world's malnourished children and says that instead of sending armies abroad, the U.S. should develop policies that confront the causes of terrorism. He proposes cutting the military budget, condemns preemptive war, and criticizes tax cuts for the rich. It's Up to Date after this hour's news. Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. His is a name from our past, but he says he has a message very much aimed at our future. Former Senator and 1972 presidential candidate George McGovern has written a new book. It's called The Essential America, and if you remember George McGovern, you won't be surprised to hear that his book is a tribute to America's liberal tradition. Liberalism is at the root of all major political, social, and economic advances going back to the nation's founding, McGovern writes in the book. Also talked to George McGovern today about Richard Nixon, George W. Bush, bombing runs during World War II, and much, much more. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning. Nice to be with you.
Nice to have you here. George McGovern served three terms in the U.S. Senate from South Dakota. He was a bomber pilot during World War II. A Medal of Freedom winner, McGovern was named in 1997 as this country's permanent representative to the U.N. Food and Agriculture Organization. He will speak tonight at 7 at the Uptown Theater in Kansas City. Tickets are available through Rainy Day Books by calling 913-384-3126. Senator, you told me before the show I could ask how old you are because you look terrific.
Well, I'm proud of how old I am. I made it to 82.
Congratulations.
My goal now is to reach 102.
Okay. What's your secret?
I work just as hard as I ever did. I don't baby myself. I keep active. I'm not only writing books, I'm making speeches around the country and doing things I enjoy. I get out and walk every day. I've got a big Newfoundland dog, female dog. She's wonderful. Those Newfoundlands will just melt your heart. And so she and I go out for a long walk a couple of times a day, and that's about all I do.
And you're spending your time between South Dakota, Montana, where else?
Florida. Spend the summers in the Rocky Mountains out in western Montana. It's one of the most beautiful areas in the world. Mm. We're in our home state of South Dakota in the fall and in the spring. And then when the snow flies in January and February, we head down to Florida for 2 or 3 months.
That's a good plan.
It's a good plan.
You've brought out your new book during a very competitive presidential election year. How come?
Well, I think we need to understand the most enduring sources of our strength as a nation. And that's the ideals of our founding fathers and the documents that they produced, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence. And then I move out of the founding fathers area to Abraham Lincoln. I include him as one of the shaping influences in American history, that great Gettysburg Address. If every American would occasionally read the Gettysburg Address.
Wouldn't take very long, would it?
No, no. Mm-hmm. It's a very short speech. The long speech that day was given by people we've forgotten about, mm-hmm. Mr. Everett. Read the Declaration of Independence. That doesn't take very long, a couple of pages. And read the preamble of the Constitution. That's about one paragraph. And then read the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. If we would stay with those principles, and I mean everybody from the president on down, we'd avoid an awful lot of trouble in our great country.
Well, one of your points in this book is that liberalism is very much at the heart of the American character and what the founding fathers intended for this country.
If we ever lost the liberal tradition, we'd lose the very lifeblood of the nation. There have been two great political traditions in American history from the very beginning, going back to the tug of war between Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton, both great men, both men who contributed much to the shaping of the foundations of our country. Jefferson would be classified as a liberal. So would Andrew Jackson. So would Abraham Lincoln, interestingly. He was more liberal than most of the Democrats of his time. Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Jack Kennedy, all these people were out of the liberal tradition. Now, that is not to denigrate the conservative tradition. My mother and father lived and died as conservative Republicans. Whether they would have voted for me in 72 if they had lived that long, I don't know. I've always thought in that one instance, maybe sentiment would have prevailed over logic. But we need both of those traditions. And what has concerned me is that over the recent period of our history, there's such an effort to scoff at liberalism, to denigrate it as though it's some kind of alien doctrine.
Well, Ronald Reagan sort of made it a bad word, didn't he?
He made it a bad word, and effectively. He was able to maintain support from a majority of the American people with a non-liberal program. I think they liked him as a person, but certainly liberalism has given us so much that is worthwhile in this country. Let me put it this way. I can't think of a single government program that is now generally endorsed by both parties that did not begin as a liberal initiative over conservative opposition. And then eventually the conservatives come around. Can I just tick off a few of these things?
I was going to say, you point to Medicare, Social Security,
sure,
the Food and Drug Administration, the Clean Air Act.
Yes, the environmental program, the whole civil rights movement. That was led by liberals. Where would this country be today if we had not had this tremendous change in American life of granting equality?
I'm thinking that conservatives would argue that in their movement has brought the end of communism, ushered in periods of great prosperity. They would say they checked the excesses of liberals over the years. And I guess you're saying we need both philosophies to keep this country going in the right direction.
We do, but I certainly wouldn't say that conservatives were the ones that primarily checked communism. The lead there was taken by Harry Truman with the Marshall Plan, with the NATO organization, with the strong positions that Truman took everywhere. His policy wasn't changed much by any administration after that for the next 50 years.
When Reagan died, the argument was that he built up America's defense budget so much that the communists couldn't keep up, and that drove him out of business.
Well, they couldn't keep up. We practically bankrupted the Soviet Union with the arms race, but that arms race was going full tilt for 50 years. Mm-hmm. Reagan didn't start that. He continued it, but it wasn't Ronald Reagan that brought about the end of the Cold War. It was the fact that their system was ready to crumble. They didn't have a good political or economic system, and it eventually broke under the strain of the Cold War.
Besides defending liberalism, there is, at a minimum, a lot of frustration in your book, and maybe even anger at what you see going on with the current administration. You don't like what you're seeing, and let me give you our listeners one example from page 20 of your book. You write, Senator, it is immoral to invade a comparatively defenseless country and kill its people because they have had the misfortune to be ruled by a ruthless dictator who our war strategists speculate might someday be a threat to us. Now, some people would be inclined to say that it would have been immoral not to invade Iraq. Tell us why you feel the way you do.
I feel that way because they were no threat to us. After President Bush Sr., with my support and the support of many people, threw Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait, which was a clear example of aggression across an international frontier, he hadn't so much as stuck his big toe beyond the borders of Iraq after that. We had him hemmed in on all sides. We had American aerial overflights every day looking at what was going on there. We had the UN international arms experts in there looking for weapons of mass destruction. There was no threat.
Well, given what we know now, do you think we should have kept him in power then?
No. I think we should have. It wasn't up to us to keep him in power. He was in power. But if we go around the world looking for every dictator that we can overthrow, we're not going to have enough young men to do it.
Well, that's a question facing this country, though, isn't it? Sort of, what is our role in terms of being the world's peacekeeper? Should we have a role, for example, in the Sudan right now? We've done programs on this show about that.
I don't think we should be the world's peacekeeper. I think that's the function of the international community. No one country should have to carry the burden of overturning dictators and maintaining peace and settling civil conflicts. This is beyond our capability, and it's beyond our right.
So in Iraq, we overstepped our boundaries.
Overstepped our bounds. It's called preemptive war. I'm sure you know from history that when the Japanese leaders were tried after World War II for the attack on Pearl Harbor, mm-hmm. which started our involvement in World War II, they said that was a preemptive strike that they did because they had information that we were getting ready to hit them. Mm. The international court didn't buy that argument. And most people around the world don't buy our argument that the preemptive war in Iraq was justified. On what basis in international law or under our Constitution, do we have the right to attack a country because we think they might someday be a threat to us?
Well, if President Bush were sitting here with us, Senator, he would say, hey, this is a new era, a new time of uncertainty. And yes, if we have credible information that a country might be gearing up to attack us, we owe it to our own people to take care of them and do what we have to do.
Well, the problem is, though, we made up that credible information that they were a threat to us. We now know what many of us believed strongly and said so before we went into Iraq, including General Wesley Clark, a four-star general, a brilliant man. He was on television repeatedly mm-hmm. before we went into Iraq saying there's no basis for this attack. And I think that's true. They didn't have weapons of mass destruction. They didn't get involved in the 9/11 tragedy. That was another falsehood that the American people were given. Now we're told that those two reasons, maybe they were wrong, but now we're there to bring democracy to Iraq.
How accountable is President Bush, in your estimation, Senator, for acting on this faulty intelligence information that everyone now acknowledges was false? Is he responsible?
Absolutely. He's the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. He's president of the United States. I don't wish him ill. I have no malice towards George Bush. As a matter of fact, I'm a friend of his father's. But I think he made a dreadful mistake in putting the American army into that Middle East cockpit. It's going to be a lot harder to get out than it was to go in. And yet every day these young men are being picked off by insurgents, by guerrilla forces who melt into the woodwork and come back to hit us next week. So I think that's the kind of thing we ought to avoid. People say to me, when I talk this way, well, don't you support our troops? And I say, you damn right I support our troops. And that's why I don't want them put into unnecessary and needless wars like Vietnam, like Iraq, and others that I understand this administration has on the drawing boards if they win this election.
You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking today with former South Dakota Senator George McGovern. His new book is called The Essential America, Our Founders and the Liberal Tradition. You say in this book, Senator, that President Bush has dwelled way too much on the axis of evil and not enough on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which you say is really at the root of the anger of so many Arabs. Tell us about that.
Well, I think that's true. You know, I've always supported the State of Israel. I admire their democratic institutions, their economy, their culture. But I think that we have been too one-sided in trying to serve as a moderator of this long, festering Arab-Israeli dispute. Too one-sided for Israel. And I don't think we're doing the Israelis a favor. We're losing our influence in the Arab world, and that's the only hope for the future security of Israel is for the United States as their principal backer and supporter to maintain some degree of influence with the Arab peoples, with the Palestinians. The best service we could render to Israel would be to follow a strictly even-handed approach in trying to bring about a settlement of this problem. There's no question that, rightly or wrongly, the Arabs perceive us as in bed with Israel. And that being the case, since they have a bitter dispute over land with Israel, they take that anger out on us. And I think that's one of the things that feeds al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden and these other militant Arab groups. They were not right to attack the Twin Towers on 9/11. We all know that. Any decent person repudiates that kind of killing of innocent Americans. But we need to ask ourselves, what drives these young Arab men that are willing to give their lives to strike back at the United States? And I think one of the problems is the way we're handling the Arab-Israeli dispute. I don't think we've done a good job there.
And that's the part of the equation we're overlooking, just this driving force. What's driving these young men to do what they're doing?
Exactly.
Young men and women, right.
You know, there's the former president of the Israeli Knesset. He wrote a piece for a distinguished Israeli magazine in earlier this year, in which he said this, and this is a direct quote. The man's name is Avraham Berg. He was president of the Israeli Knesset from 1999 to 2003. Just listen to these two words. We cannot keep a Palestinian majority under an Israeli boot and at the same time think ourselves the only democracy in the Middle East. And then he adds this sentence, we must remove all of the settlements and draw an internationally recognized border between the Israeli national home and the Palestinian national home. That's my formula for peace between, and it comes from a very distinguished Israeli.
Let me turn to a different topic. The last time I saw you was a couple of years ago at the dedication of the new Dole Center over in Lawrence. Your old colleague, Senator Dole, was in the news this week for criticizing John Kerry in the controversy over Kerry's war record. What do you have to say to Senator Dole? What did you think of that attack, Senator?
Well, you know, Bob Dole and I are old friends, and we formed a bipartisan coalition in the Senate, and we got just about everything we went after in the areas of agriculture.
Food stamps
mm-hmm. and school lunches and the WIC program, all those other programs, and I think very highly of him. And he himself was a distinguished veteran in World War II, terribly wounded. He still bears the scars of that wound. I wish he had not gotten into this fray over John Kerry's service in the Vietnam War. Bob is objecting to the fact that Kerry, after he came back from Vietnam, turned against the war. Well, who didn't? Mm-hmm. You know, many GIs over there, including my son-in-law, who fought very bravely as a Marine. He was a volunteer. But when he got back to this country and started to read about the history of our involvement there, and the fact that Vietnam was no threat whatsoever to the United States. He turned against the war, too.
Why would you speculate that Senator Dole is speaking out in this very harsh way that he is right now?
Well, Bob is a Republican, let's face it. Mm-hmm. That's no reflection on him. He's a loyal Republican. He wants to do what he can to help the Bush campaign. I can only tell you that as a friend, I was somewhat disappointed mm-hmm. that he took this position. You know, if you stop to think about it, isn't it ridiculous that we have a situation where President Bush and Vice President Cheney have never spent one day on a battlefield? The president was in the Texas National Guard for a few months. Mm-hmm. Cheney said when he was asked why he'd never been in uniform, he said, "I had other priorities." And yet here are these two men attacking John Kerry, or doing it through these front groups, mm-hmm. And arguing that he exaggerated his heroism in the war. Mm. He was wounded three times. You don't get the Purple Heart because you say, ouch. If somebody has to put you in for that, some superior officer.
Let me turn to a couple of other subjects you broach in your book, and one has to do with the hungry of the world, and you have been working on the hungry for many years of your life. You advocate in this book a universal school lunch program. How come?
You know, the school lunch program was one of the best things we have ever enacted in this country. Senator Dole and I were responsible for doubling the size of that school lunch program. And he has joined with me in another effort that I first proposed when I was the U.S. ambassador in Rome, dealing with world hunger. And that is that there are 300 million school-age kids who are not now being fed during the school days mm-hmm. around the world. Of that 300 million, 120 million don't even go to school, mostly girls, because of the favoritism towards us males in most societies. What we're proposing is that the United Nations, with the United States taking the lead, provide a good, nutritious lunch every day for every one of those 300 million youngsters not now being fed. There are three things that happen when you start a school lunch program under those conditions. First, enrollment jumps. Both the boys and the girls get to school. Secondly, academic performance goes up and the health of the children improves. Thirdly, the little illiterate girls who stay at home, they get married as early as 10, 11, 12 years of age. They have an average of 6 children. The ones that go to school, even if it's just for the first 6 elementary years, they marry later in life. They have a better sense of what life is all about. They have an average of 2.9. Hmm. In other words, you slightly more than cut in half the birth rate, and that's without abortions.
Not to mention the goodwill America would engender if we did something like this.
You know, if we were doing this all over the world, and we've gotten started on it, we got $300 million from President Clinton before he left office. We've got another $200 million. Since then, we're feeding children in 38 countries, not all of them, but a sizable beginning. And that's doing us more good than almost anything else we could do.
Time for a break. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking today with former South Dakota Senator George McGovern. He's author of the new book, The Essential America, Our Founders and a Liberal Tradition. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. We're joined this hour by former presidential candidate and three-term South Dakota Senator George McGovern. His new book is called The Essential America. We'll continue our conversation with what some have called America's best-known and most consistent liberal and welcome you into the conversation, too, with your phone calls and email on Up to Date after these Kansas City news headlines.
For KCUR News, I'm Michael Byers. Two black farmers from Kansas have filed lawsuits against the U.S. Department of Agriculture seeking $40 million as compensation for alleged racial discrimination by the agency, saying it threatens to force them off their land. The lawsuits were filed in Washington, D.C. this week on behalf of George Hildebrandt of the Leavenworth area and Rodney Bradshaw of the Jetmore area. They're the latest in more than a dozen lawsuits by civil rights attorney James Myert, Jr., based on an environmental working group report that says thousands of black farmers have been denied payment under a landmark settlement of bias complaints against the USDA. Overland Park-based Sprint Corporation has secured another marketing deal with a major cable television company. The telecommunications giant will offer internet phone service to the 2.7 million customers of Mediacom Communications Corporation. Middletown, New York-based Mediacom, the nation's eighth-largest cable provider, says it hopes to begin offering the service to its customers in 23 states early next year. Kansas City-based H&R Block is blaming rising interest rates for its $44 million loss in the second quarter. Block says business at its mortgage lending units was down as the cost of home loans rose. Chief Executive Mark Ernst was not overly concerned by the news yesterday. He said he expected the lower numbers and assured investors that the company will still reach its financial objectives for the year. This is KCUR.
And welcome back to the second half of Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Our guest today, former South Dakota Senator George McGovern. If you have a question for the senator, our number here, 816-235-2888. Again, that's area code 816-235-2888. Our email address is updatedate@kcur.org. Senator, you've done an awful lot in your 82 years, from World War II, three terms in the Senate. You ran for president, raised a family by all accounts you're very proud of. What's been the highlight of your career and your years here?
Oh, it was winning the Democratic presidential nomination. That's the Super Bowl, when you get in and have an opportunity to go back and forth across this great country and talk to millions of people and meet millions of people. It was the highlight of my life and always will be, I think.
When you look back on that campaign, obviously the question would be, any second thoughts, any second guesses about how you ran that campaign against Richard Nixon?
I think there are two things that explained the landslide defeat that we suffered. Number one was the shooting of George Wallace. He was very strong as a third-party figure. He had run in 68 and got 10 million votes, largely at the expense of Richard Nixon,
right.
almost elected Hubert Humphrey. He'd have gotten 20 million votes in 72 because he'd entered all the Democratic primaries. So when he was shot a month before the convention, I think Nixon was home free, mm-hmm. in terms of, because you had that huge Wallace vote merging with the votes of an incumbent president who was well entrenched, running against a junior senator from South Dakota with three electoral votes. So looking back on it, mm-hmm. I think that was the blow that turned what otherwise might have been a rather close race.
What was the second thing?
The second thing was the trouble over the vice presidential selection.
I was going to ask you.
I picked a perfectly good man, Tom Eagleton of Missouri, a wonderful senator.
Still practicing law over in St. Louis.
He's a great figure. One of the, if I were to do it over again, I would not have permitted the pressure to ask him to step down to prevail. Mm-hmm. I think we should have stayed with him. We were just beginning to discover some things about clinical depression. And I think even then, the experts knew enough about it that we probably could have been in a stronger position if we just have stayed with that choice. Now, I had a wonderful man who took his place, Sergeant Shriver. But when you have that kind of a shift as the first thing that happens in a presidential campaign, you break your momentum.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish we'd have just plowed right straight ahead with Senator Eagleton.
Were you ever angry at Senator Eagleton for not disclosing his problems to you, even privately?
I wish he had done that, and I think he does too.
Mm-hmm.
He thought it was something that was in his past that wasn't bothering him anymore and that would never come out, so why jeopardize his political advancement by talking about something that he felt was behind him? I have to confess, I didn't know much about mental illness in those days. I had to learn a lot more about it later on in my own family. But it was a terrific blow to the campaign. And then the fact that to get that nomination, I had to defeat 16 other Democratic contenders, men like Hubert Humphrey and Ed Muskie and Scoop Jackson, Mayor John Lindsay, a whole string of very strong people. By the time I got to the convention and won the nomination, there were so many broken heads and injured feelings around the country that greatly handicapped us.
How did losing a presidential race in a landslide, how's that affected you over the years?
Well, obviously, there's a certain amount of sadness with it. I'm not going to deny that. I was was saddened.
Embarrassed?
Not embarrassed, because I thought I did the best I could. I thought I said exactly what I believed on public issues. I've never had to apologize for anything that I said on the great issues before the country. But I got over that, and I learned a year after the election when President Nixon, who had scored that landslide win, was thrown out of the White House in an almost unanimous bipartisan vote. I learned that there's some things worse that can happen to you than losing an election. Hmm. I've never had any desire to trade places with the landslide winner.
Have you ever spoken to Richard Nixon? Did you ever speak to him in the years after that election?
Yes, I did. I went to see him in New York 10 years after he resigned, and we had a good visit.
Just you and he?
Just the two of us. We met at his daughter Trisha's apartment in New York, and we had a good talk. I saw him again later on an airplane. He was sitting across the aisle from me with a Secret Service agent, and he noticed that no one was sitting next to me. He said, "Do you mind if I come over and see you?" I said, "Of course, Mr. President. I'd love to talk with you." That was also about the 10th year after he had left office, but we had a good visit that time.
What do you recall about meeting him in Trisha's apartment? What did you talk about?
I went up there to see if he would be willing to join with me in urging President Reagan to meet with the Russian leader. I knew that President Nixon had said repeatedly when he was in the White House that no American president should ever let a year go by without meeting with the head of the other superpower. President Reagan let the first 4 years go by without a meeting. So I went up to see if maybe the two of us could join in a bipartisan statement to urge President Reagan to meet with his Soviet counterpart.
And did he agree?
He said, of course, he should do that. But he said, "George, I have a little influence with Reagan. I'm afraid I would lose it if I team up with a prominent Democrat." Hmm. And he said another thing. This morning, I got a call from President Reagan at 9 o'clock. My meeting with him was at 10, and he was wishing me a happy 70th birthday. I didn't know that it was his birthday. And he said, "This may seem like a small thing to you, but it's kind of hard just after the President of the United States wishes you a happy birthday, and you team up with one of the leading Democrats in the country to urge him to do something he doesn't want to do."
You know, not to belabor this, but was your time with him, was it awkward? Was it relaxed? How was it?
Well, you know, I found President Nixon more relaxed than I had ever recalled in any previous time. I've always thought that President Nixon, this isn't a criticism, it's just an observation, was kind of uptight and almost artificial sometimes in dealing with people. This time he was relaxed. He was easygoing. We had a pleasant conversation, and we never talked about the Vietnam War, and we never talked about the 72 election, which was wise. We simply talked about other things. Incidentally, the thing he wanted to talk about was our Middle East policy. He said, "You know, we've got to quit being so one-sided. We've got to talk to those Arabs, and we have to listen to their side of the case.
The same thing you just advocated.
The same thing that you and I were talking about here earlier today, and I agreed with him. And then he said something that's interesting. He said, you know, every president becomes more even-handed towards the Middle East after they leave office.
That's interesting.
He was talking about the political pressures here at home.
Our guest today is former South Dakota Senator George McGovern. He's an author and former World War II bomber pilot. We'll get to some of those topics here in just a few moments. Our phone number again, 816-235-2888. The email address is updatedate@kcur.org. Frank from Lawrence, good morning.
Hey, Senator McGovern, glad to talk to you.
Same to you.
You might recall the name of my father, Francis Kelly. He was on Hubert Humphrey's staff.
Absolutely. I recall him well.
And he quit Humphrey's staff over the Vietnam War. And he went to work for Orville Freeman then and in private practice. But that I think that was the heartbreak of the 60s and 70s for America. And I'd like to add another reason why I think you lost was Kissinger's lie that peace was at hand in October, an October surprise, so to speak.
But yes, I think that's true. One of the things that just about turned me inside out, since I had opposed that war for 10 years, and President Nixon had always supported it from the very beginning to the very end, is that a poll came out just before the election showing that a majority of Americans thought that President Nixon would more likely end the war in Vietnam than George McGovern. I just couldn't swallow that.
Hard to believe. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about vote reform, election reform. Do you think we need to do away with the Electoral College?
I do. I think it served whatever purpose its instigators intended in the early days of the country when we didn't have the kind of communications we have today. I want to be honest, I haven't led a crusade at any time in my life to end the Electoral College. But in view of what happened 4 years ago, here you have Al Gore with a plurality of 550,000 votes, and the other guy wins the election because of the vagaries of the Election College and the most partisan Supreme Court decision, I think, in the 20th century. I think the time has come to do away with the Electoral College.
Frank, thanks for your phone call. And Senator, you just mentioned the Vietnam War and your longtime opposition to it. How do you feel today about the Democratic nominee, John Kerry, and so many Democrats who signed off on that war with their votes a couple of years ago? How do you feel about that?
Well, I think John Kerry has talked about his record in Vietnam not because he believes in that war, which of course he doesn't. He thought it was a dreadful mistake, but to show that as a young man he had the courage to volunteer for service in that war. At the time he volunteered, he believed in the war. After he got over there and saw what was going on and then came home and began to study the Vietnam issue, he turned against it. But you can't really blame him for reminding the country that he was a combat soldier.
How about the votes on the Iraqi war we are engaged in right now?
Well, obviously, I wish Senator Kerry had not voted for the war resolution. I wish he'd have stayed with his senior Massachusetts colleague, Ted Kennedy, and with Bob Byrd of West Virginia. But I think he was misled. I think when the top officials in the government, including the president, told the Senate and the House that they had intelligence showing that Iraq not only had weapons of mass destruction, but that they were aimed at the United States, the vice president went so far as to say, we may see the first evidence of this in a mushroom cloud, indicating that they had nuclear weapons that would show us something like Hiroshima. So I regret the vote for the war resolution. Of course I do. But I think they were misled.
Okay. Let's say hi to Stan from Kansas City, Missouri. You're on Up to Date, Stan.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. I want to tell Senator McGovern that I had the great privilege of eating lunch with him years and years ago at Clark University, where I was on the faculty.
Well, good for you. That's where my
Daughter went.
Daughter Mary went and graduated from there. And,
yes, and I was a supporter of yours. I voted for you. I would vote for you again. You're a man of honor and integrity.
You think I should go for it at 82?
Oh, anyway, time passes all of us by. I was a Marine in the Korean War, and those days are over with, which brings me to a subject. I have never been so disillusioned with the political process and the love, the obscene campaign strategies that have been used by the incumbent party. I find it absolutely disgraceful.
I think that's right. I think that the campaigns are too negative. They're too destructive. We need to get back to a reasoned discourse between competing candidates.
Go ahead, Stan.
Okay. The last thing is, I've always been a great admirer of Senator Kennedy. I moved here from Massachusetts. I find him a person of integrity and one of the great senators in terms of liberal issues in the Senate. And I wonder what happened to the base of the Democratic Party. Why doesn't anybody present themselves with real, genuine liberal ideas? And
let's get a response, Stan.
That's the purpose of this book I've written, The Essential America, Our Founders and the Liberal Tradition. I agree with what you've just said, every bit of it. But I think this book is the best I can do in laying out reasoned arguments why we need to preserve and strengthen the liberal tradition in this country. America is going to be a greatly diminished country if its enemies succeed in destroying the liberal tradition.
Who did you back originally for president this time around?
I supported General Wesley Clark.
Mm-hmm.
He was on television repeatedly before the war, urging us not to go into Iraq and warning about the hazards there. He was first in his class at West Point. It's hard even to get into West Point, and to come in first academically shows a real brain. He was a distinguished Rhodes Scholar, a distinguished four-star general, and I thought he would make a strong candidate for the Democrats, but I'm now supporting Kerry and Edwards. I think they're strong, intelligent, wise men, and I wish them well.
George McGovern is our guest today on Up to Date, and one of your other books, Senator, and you've written eight others, by the way, was about your daughter, Terry, who died from alcoholism some years ago. What have you learned about that disease in the years since, and what do you tell audiences today about your experience with your daughter?
Well, that was the saddest book I'll ever write. There's nothing quite like losing one of your children. It doesn't make any difference whether they're 5, 15, or 45. In fact, the longer they've been with you, the more memories and sadness you have about losing them.
And how old was Terry?
She was 45.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She was a wonderful young woman, highly intelligent person with a warm, engaging personality, one of the wittiest, most humorous people I've ever known, but she was an alcoholic. She was seriously addicted to alcohol.
And she was up in Wisconsin at Madison, I think, right?
She was living at Madison, Wisconsin. She had gone for a while to Clark University in Massachusetts, and then later to the University of Wisconsin, and she continued to live in Madison. She went through all kinds of treatment programs and AA meetings and reading the writings of clergymen and the Oriental philosophers and so on. And sometimes those efforts would work. She was sober once for 8 years. It was during that period that she fell in love and later had two wonderful little girls who are doing splendidly today.
Hmm.
But always the relapse would come. And finally, we were expecting her home for Christmas in 1994. We lived in Washington, D.C. then, and my wife and I went out to dinner just before Christmas, I think maybe the 23rd, maybe possibly the 22nd of Christmas. And it was a wonderful time in a favorite restaurant of ours, all kinds of Christmas music and so on. And we came home, it was about 11:15. Eleanor went upstairs to bed and began reading a novel. And I stayed down in the living room, played the piano for a while, not well, but enthusiastically, and threw a log on the fire. And I was reading a Harper's Magazine when the doorbell rang about midnight. And I wondered, who in the dickens could this be? We lived in a kind of a secluded part of Washington, but as I approached the front door, I could see a police officer standing on one side of the glass and a clergyman on the other. I still didn't know what was happening, but I let them in, and the officer said, "Senator, we're awfully sorry to come to your house at Christmas time with such sad news, but your daughter, Teresa Jane McGovern, was found dead today, frozen to death in the snow of Madison, Wisconsin." That was the worst hour of my life, losing this wonderful young woman. Since then, I've studied more intently alcoholism. We don't really know its causes. Mm-hmm. It certainly has a hereditary factor. That isn't the only cause, but it's one cause. If there's a strong tendency in that direction in the family. And the environment, the social environment, peer pressure, binge drinking on the weekends, all these things can tip you over into addiction. So I've been working with groups that are interested in that subject. We set up a little foundation. Any income I get from this book, I put into that foundation mm-hmm. to help in research on alcoholism and the possible recovery from it.
But despite very strong efforts on her part, she just couldn't lick it.
She just couldn't seem to do it. I don't know, in my experience, I don't know any person who worked harder to get on top of that addiction to alcohol than did Terry. She seemed to do all the right things, and she'd go along okay for a while, and then the relapse would come.
I'm wondering about the burden on you you and your wife during those years that created.
It's tough. They say that alcoholism is a family disease, and what they mean by that is that it may have some hereditary background, but more specifically, they mean that it almost afflicts everybody in the family, in that it diminishes your happiness. It adds to the uncertainty of life.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we're all going to a wedding, and the alcoholic decides that's a good time to get drunk. Maybe you're planning a picnic. Maybe you're planning a trip to the mm-hmm. city or to Europe, and alcohol takes over and ruins everybody's good time.
So there's still some mystery attached to what happened to her and what could help other people in a similar state.
There's lots of mystery. I personally regard it as the number one health problem in America. There are 100,000 Americans who die every year from alcoholism. We are understandably saddened about the 3,000 people that were killed on 9/11, but we kill 35 times that many people every year from alcoholism. Most of the people who are in prison or in jails are there because of alcohol-related problems. Many divorces, many child mm-hmm. molestations, many wife spousal abuse cases go to alcoholism. The loss of jobs, inefficiency on the job, declining academic standards, declining athletic performance. all these things related to alcoholism.
And preventing this, how do we do it?
Well, I think we have to do a better job with education. You know, I'm an old school teacher. I think education can help any cause. I think we need to know more about it. I think we need to acquaint our children about this danger at a very early age.
Mm-hmm.
Terry told me one day before she died that she started drinking at the age of 9 or 10. I couldn't believe it. She'd go to a party somewhere where people had glasses sitting mm-hmm. down, and she'd drain the last half of the glass. By the time she was a teenager, she was addicted to alcohol.
Let me turn to one other book you wrote. I'm changing topics probably too abruptly here, but our time's a little short. You wrote a book about your experiences in World War II as a bomber pilot, and I think I recall reading that a few years ago you went back to a farmhouse in Germany that you had bombed during the war and met with the people who live there even still today. Tell us about that reunion, a reunion of sorts.
Well, it's a marvelous story. By the way, the book you're talking about was actually authored by Professor Stephen Ambrose, but I'm the central character.
Right, that's right.
It's called The Wild Blue, The Men and Boys Who Flew the B-24s in World War II. I flew a full string of 35 bombing missions against the most heavily defended targets in Europe. I'm lucky to be here today. One day, the boys in the rear of the airplane called up and said that one of the 10 bombs that we had dropped on the target, which was an oil refinery, had jammed in the bomb rack, had not fallen.
Mm.
And I said, well, you guys got to get rid of that bomb. I'm not going to land this airplane with a bomb dangling in the rack there. I'd never heard of such a thing happening.
Right.
I came out of the formation and came down from altitude to about 10 or 12,000 feet. We usually were flying at around 25,000. And the bomb broke loose, and it fell right on a little farmyard.
Mm.
On the Italian-Austrian border. It was exactly 12 noon. Peaceful little green village out there. The building just took off in all directions. I thought, oh my gosh.
Senator, we're running a little short on time. Go quickly to meeting
right.
the people. Yeah.
I thought we'd killed everybody there. And I told that story on television in Austria 45 years later. An elderly farmer called that night and said, that was my farm, but we saw the bomber coming. I got my wife and children into a ditch. Nobody was hurt, so I got redemption after all
these
years.
Well, that's a great story, a great clearing of your conscience so many years later. George McGovern, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
Nice to have you here. He will speak this evening at 7 at the Uptown Theater at 3700 Broadway in Kansas City. Tickets are available through Rainy Day Books at 913-384-3126. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.